This Week in Free Energy.
Imagine a world in which each home has its own power generator that obtains its energy in such a way that no fuel has to be added. Imagine every vehicle being able to run without ever stopping for fuel. Imagine each appliance having its own power source that never has to be recharged. That is the world of the future. Join with us now as we track our progress towards such a world.
Hello, this is Sterling Allen. You have joined us at Free Energy Now, brought to you by PES Network. On the web at freeenergynow.net, and daily our news is at freeenergynews.com. Today we are joined by Roger Davey. He is the CEO and Executive Chairman of EnviroMission, also known as the solar tower technologies that you've seen that at one point they were talking about a 1,000-meter high tower. Roger, thank you for joining us.
Thank you very much for your interest.
It's great to have you on today. This has been a technology I've been very impressed with for some time. You are listed in our top 100 energy technologies, and I've seen your video online. It's a very well done video. It's one that we're hoping to use for a documentary that we're coming up with on alternative energy technologies.
Yeah, that was a video that was put together by one of the universities in Australia, and was put together for a submission that we gave to government, also to a major presentation we gave to the Institute of Directors here in this country.
Mm-hmm. So tell us briefly, what is a solar tower? How does it work?
Well, I'll go through the very simple method first. If you could imagine a vast greenhouse, a roof, a translucent roof, a roof made of a translucent material, about a meter off the ground from the outside, sloping gently towards the center, upwards towards the center. In the center of this vast greenhouse is a massive tower. Around the base of that tower are a number of turbines. The sun effectively, or solar radiation, beats down on the roof of that greenhouse. It warms the air underneath it. Hot air rises, and the air runs gently towards the center, and then gets sucked through the turbines and up and out of the tower. The tower effectively creates a chimney effect. And as you would know in America on a cold day, when you light a fire inside, the smoke goes whoosh up the chimney. Mm-hmm. And the updraft, it's effectively exactly the same thing. The height of the tower creates the temperature differential to create that updraft. So very simplistically, it is a cooling tower, if you like, or a chimney, a greenhouse, and turbines. And uses only the heat from the sun, and produces nothing but electricity and warm air, so no CO2 at all.
You've had a prototype in operation, 7 years on this?
Yes, a prototype was built in Spain in the 80s, was built in conjunction with the Spanish government and the German government, and the engineers at that time were a group under Schlack Bergemann. That tower was built purely to prove the technology worked. In effect, it was a laboratory model built outside because the tower was a couple of meters high and it covered about 8 acres. So
that was
it was too big to build inside.
Meters, is that 280 meters high?
200 meters high.
200.
Yeah.
And the skirt was how big?
About three hectares, about eight acres.
Okay. And over the 7 years you ran this, what did you find in terms of energy efficiency?
Well, what it was to do was to prove that the height of the tower would influence the airflow to drive turbines, and that we could capture the heat from the sun under the collector roof. One of the most interesting things about all that, one of the interesting things about it was people were thinking that we would probably create a desert underneath that collector roof because of the heat. Exactly to the contrary, because natural condensation had created quite lush growth. So it had a number of benefits apart from electricity.
Did you grow things intentionally underneath that?
No, we did not. No.
But just naturally, the
natural condensation, yes.
Uh-huh. Now, you have some newer technology since that. You've got a new way of storing the heat and better a capturing of the heat. Could you talk about both of those?
Yes. What happened was when this big monster, as you mentioned earlier, I think in your introduction, the tower itself was to be a kilometre high, 1,000 metres high. It had to be, at that point in time, it had to be big to create enough power.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the economics of the project were sound at that point in time, but there were a number of risks. There was the risk of, you know, when construction companies had never built anything a kilometre high, it would have been, 2.5 times or 2.3 times the height of the Empire State Building, I think, roughly.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's a thing called construction risk. There was a thing called technology risk. I mean, no one had ever built anything of this size before, so would it produce the power required? So we as a company took the view to find a way to make it work harder and more efficiently. If you could imagine, first thing in the morning, it's creating power because of the heat from the day before, but then as the sun gets up and the heat increases, it almost created power like a probability curve or a bell curve, with the sun coming up in the morning, hitting its peak mid to, say, midday to mid-afternoon, and going down at night time. And that would mirror the demand profile during the day of the power users. But what happens if you have hot nights or hot mornings? You've got to make this thing produce power more akin to a coal-fired plant. You have to compete with traditional energy producers. You can't be, or we took the view we couldn't be, like, say, a wind farm that produces power intermittently, i.e. only when the wind blows. We wanted to make this thing produce power as and when required or on demand. So we came up with a new roofing structure or a new roofing material that has enabled us not only to capture more heat, but to retain more heat. And in tests, the temperatures got up well over 85 degrees centigrade underneath this roof.
Mm-hmm.
So it's far, far hotter. Now, as mentioned earlier, with the tower wanting being built to create the temperature differential, so it had to be high to create the temperature differential between the temperature at the top of the tower and the temperature of the ground to create that updraft. The temperature drops approximately 1 degree every 100 metres as you go up. So you're creating a natural temperature differential. If you create more heat at ground level, you may not need to have such a tall tower. So that's how we've managed to reduce the height of the tower slightly. And the method of heat storage is we've created a storage facility whereby we can take heat from that facility at somewhere between 35 and 50 degrees centigrade above ambient temperature. So whenever there's times of slightly lower solar radiation or at night time, mm-hmm. or, you know, simplistically on cooler days or in winter itself, we can create that heat underneath the collector to drive those turbines to produce electricity. So we've created a far more efficient product that can compete effectively with the output of a coal-fired plant or a fossil fuel plant.
Tell us about the storage. What is it a salt of some kind? Is it a solid? Is it a thermal mass? How are you storing the heat?
It's being used via things called solar ponds, which are a saline pond. And if you can imagine creating different densities of water by adding different levels of salt to them, and the water effectively stays in its own strata, it's like a piece of sedimentary rock. You know, when you cut through a cliff of sedimentary rock, you've got different layers of rock. The water stays in its own set stratas because of the different densities. And we can effectively make the water at the bottom of these ponds boil just from natural solar radiation. So it's a very effective method of storing heat.
And how are you able to selectively release that heat?
That is a patented process that EnviroMission owns, where we remove that heat from the ponds and run it through a heat exchange and then place it back into the ponds, very simplistically.
Now, on the design, the animation that was put up out by this university, they showed turbines, if I remember right, both on the exterior of the, around the perimeter of the skirt, as well as coming into the base of the tower.
No, the turbines are at the base of the tower. There's nothing at the perimeter of the skirt. The turbines are at the base of tower, approximately on that big one, they're about 100 meters from the tower itself.
Now you were talking with your previous design. They were anticipating that you would basically have desert conditions that would not support life because of the heat under these, but that the humidity showed that to be wrong. With this increased heat that you're having, with this increased collection on this new design, do you think that will still be the case, that you'll be able to grow things underneath this skirt?
I doubt it, but it still could be used for some form of agriculture, and that's something that will come out in the final design. Where we're building this plant, the first plant, which is being built at a place called Tapio Station, about 22 kilometres outside of Mildura. Mildura, in Australia, for your listeners, is a food basket. It's one of the major producers of grapes and citrus fruits and a lot of pretty good wine, obviously, from the area. It also produces a lot of dried fruit. So perhaps, and I'm not saying definitely, but perhaps it could be used as a drying facility to get that done far quicker than the way that's being done currently. But I think it'll be too hot for normal agricultural business, yes.
Mm-hmm. Now, coming into... In the artist rendition, they show at the top of this tower a visitor center of sort where people can actually walk around and look down inside of the tower. Do you plan on having that in your first plant?
That will depend on who owns the plant initially or what the costings of the plant and how she ships out. That plant originally on that artist rendition or on that video was the kilometre high tower.
Mm-hmm.
We altered the size from a 200 megawatt plant, which was the original plant, to a 50 megawatt plant to fit with the government's low emission technology demonstration fund.
Mm-hmm.
And we tailored our application and tailored our development procedure to meet that fund. So it was a substantially smaller sized plant. But having said that, it had a very, very big increase in power output because of the new technologies. In fact, a little 50 megawatt plant would have produced almost half the power of the original 200 megawatt plant.
Meaning the size of the 50 megawatt plant with the increased efficiencies would be 100 megawatt?
No, that's a 50. Right, sorry. A 200 megawatt power plant, what you've got to look at is the capacity factor of the plant, i.e. how often it runs. A coal-fired plant, for example, runs about 80 to 85% of the time. Because part of the time it's turned off for maintenance and cleaning turbines and the burners and all that sort of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
With a wind farm, you look at the capacity factor. The capacity factor might be as low as 15 or 16%, or as high as maybe 25%, i.e. the wind is blowing 25% of the time to produce power.
Mm-hmm.
Now, when you look at when I mentioned a 50 megawatt plant, that's the installed capacity.
Okay.
And you've got to look at how often that runs and then look at the megawatt hour production. Now, at a 50 megawatt plant running at an 80% capacity factor would produce about 350 gigawatt hours. But a 40% capacity factor, obviously about 175 gigawatt hours. And the original tower that we were going to build had a capacity factor approaching 40%. We're looking at a capacity factor approaching 80% on the new improved tower.
Help us understand what this 650 gigawatt hours is. That over a period of 1 month, a week, a year?
A year.
Okay.
That's for the big plant.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
And so with the new design, you're moving from 40% up to 80%. Capacity.
That's what it looks like. What we've found is that when you increased, and I'll get the number, I'll try and be as accurate as I can with the numbers because I don't have the actual document sitting with me, but when we added the new roofing materials, we got up to about a 10% increase in power output. And at the middle of the day, a substantially greater increase in power output because of the far greater heat. Now, that would have only happened from about 10 o'clock in the morning until 4 or 5 o'clock in the afternoon. That is when the sun is up. When we added the heat from our storage facility, we found that we could get 100% output from any time we brought the heat in. So what we decided to do in our modelling and everything else was to bring the heat in at 6 o'clock in the morning and take it out at 8 o'clock at night, just for testing. At 6 o'clock in the morning, we had the plant running at 100% capacity, and from 4 o'clock until 8 o'clock in the evening, we had it running at 100% capacity. That's in the modelling. And so what it showed is this increase in heat gave us a far, far greater power output profile and therefore demonstrated far greater efficiencies and far greater scalability, i.e. we could make smaller plants, and also far greater flexibility that we could meet the power demand profile. Because when you sell your power, you're either going to sell it, the power will go into the power grid and will be sold by retailers. And the power retailers, you would want to try to meet their demand profile so you can get a far greater price for your power and not just have power coming in when you produce it. You want to be able to produce the power when they need it, which is one of the issues with some of the other renewable energy projects out there, that you are reliant on producing the power when the facility is able to produce, i.e. with photovoltaics and things like that, it's when the sun is up. And with wind, it's when the wind blows. What we appear to have done is have a plant that can run 7 days a week, 24 hours a day, 365 days a year, if that is the requirement of the retailer or the community in which we're producing power for.
Now, obviously, in some places you're going to have, even in the ideal desert locations for a facility like this, you're still going to have some cloud cover time. How do you compensate for that?
It works in diffuse sunlight. It's worked by solar radiation. Solar radiation comes through clouds. You can still get sunburnt through clouds. That's not an issue. That is not a problem.
So cloud cover does not diminish significantly your output?
No, it does not. No.
Huh. And that was something that you were able to show with your prototype?
That was certainly demonstrated by the prototype. It's been demonstrated since. Yeah.
And your new increased efficiency in harvesting or collecting the sun's rays, the 10% increase with the new collectors, that is also something that's been has shown collection during cloudy times.
Yes, the new roofing structure is a proven technology that was developed by the University of Melbourne in Australia in consultation with the CSIRO, which at that point in time was a government research body. That was obviously not built for the solar car because the solar car was not being commercialised when this was done, but it was a proven technology that had never been applied to a solar tower. What we have done is taken it and modified it so it suits our purpose. And yes, it has been proven.
Now, if I understand right, you are not the only solar tower company in the world.
Who else is there?
Let me see here. On our website, we have a profile of, let me pull it up here, and rather than wait for me right now, we can go on, but I'll pull up the names here if I can. It could just be that I'm confusing. I know you have a different name for your U.S. operation than you do for your Australian operation.
Solar Emission Technologies is the U.S. operation. Solar Emission Technologies is the company that was formed in, it was an existing company. We changed the name, I think, going back to, might have been 1999, when I obtained the technology. And I placed the technology into the U.S. company and then sub-licensed Australia with the rights to develop in Australia. And the Australian company has now developed these new technologies, which it now owns. But I believe we are the only developer of solar towers in the world at this stage.
Okay.
That is. Yeah.
So the
and, of course, we will be the only developer with the new technologies because they are owned and patented by ourselves.
Uh-huh. How many patents do you have involved in your company?
Oh, there's a number of patents and an awful lot of intellectual property, which is very closely guarded also.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Now, in talking about this 50-megawatt plant,
yes.
Which is the full capacity or installed capacity, when do you anticipate you'll be able to get that thing up and running?
We it will depend. We are currently moving forward on a change in the size because of the result of the low emission technology, or partial result of low emission technology demonstration fund, where a photovoltaic plant by the name, I've forgotten the name of the company, obtained a grant to build that plant. We are, the 50 megawatt plant that we were planning to build, as mentioned, was tailored for the low emission technology demonstration fund application. It is not necessarily the most efficient. We are now working with our partners, both the construction company and our engineering consultants, to optimize the size plant and the power output to give us the greatest economy of scale, if you like, to provide banking. So we will be moving forward without the limitations of the low emission technology demonstration fund.
Okay. You are a public
It may not be a 50 megawatt plant.
You are a publicly traded company, correct?
Yes, we are.
And
An announcement to that effect went to the stock exchange in Australia on Friday morning.
Okay. So this is new news. I was not aware of that.
Yes.
Okay. Now, just for the U.S. and other country outside of Australia listeners, what does that mean in terms of people who might be interested in investing or putting money in the stock?
Okay, we are listed on the on a U.S. exchange. We're a pink sheet company on the States, an OTC market. We have an American depository receipt program that's fully sponsored by the Bank of New York, and the trading code for that is EVOMY. And I guess if they speak to their broker or bang up pinksheets.com and punch in EVOMY, you will see our trading on that quotation.
Okay.
So it can be bought over there. Now, with an American depository receipt, that is Australian shares that are registered, transfer registered with the Bank of New York, and a depository receipt is issued by the Bank of New York to their broker. And the ratio of that depository receipt program is 20 Enviro Emission shares for each one American depository receipt. So
in Australia, the coal fire plants are the standard for commercial or conventional electricity generation. Is that correct?
Yes, we are, and that's I think that's a very good point, because Australia is a very, very resource-rich country and has an abundance of good black coal. A lot of the black coal, which is an anthracite, is exported abroad and used in the northern states for the production of power. In the southern states, such as Victoria, where I come from, which is on the bottom right-hand side of a map of Australia for anybody that knows what Australia looks like, I guess, we have stuff called lignite, which is, pardon me, it's a very shitty brown coal, and it's a very wet brown coal, and it's a very polluting coal when you burn it. In fact, for each, and these are not my figures, these are figures produced by the Australian Greenhouse Office, for each kilowatt of electricity produced, about 1.5 kilograms of CO2 goes into the atmosphere. So it's a highly polluting product. With anthracite or black coal, it's about a kilogram. So it's 1.5 times as polluting as normal coal or high quality coal.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what we hope to be able to address with what we do, where we produce no CO2.
Now, you are aiming to be able to be competitive price-wise with coal in a country where coal is abundantly available, polluting, albeit polluting, which is not something that's being factored into the present price. And you're going to be able to be competitive with that. How would that compute in American language to cents per kilowatt hour?
If you're looking at in Australia, the power companies sell, no, that's not right. There's a base black or a power price, and these are going to be approximate numbers, so if they're slightly out, don't hold me to it. But say about 5 cents Australian for power, and then there are renewable energy credits in this country, which is a mandated not a carbon tax, but sort of a little bit like a renewable energy benefit of about 4 cents. So we will get probably somewhere between 8 and 10 cents for our power, with the benefit, the government benefit. Now, no renewable project in this country will get up without some form of incentive. We will compete production-wise or output-wise with a coal-fired plant, but to get the first number of plants up, you certainly need some form of government help. But looking at what's going on in the United States at the moment, we've looked at land in Arizona, Nevada, Texas, New Mexico, Eastern California, and in fact we look like getting access to some land in Arizona imminently. And the power prices in the United States, and I'm going to be correct, I think some power purchase agreements are being written around the 8 or 9 US cents per kilowatt for power, which would be far better and far more advantageous than what we can achieve in Australia. So it's more attractive to build a solar tower in the southwest of the United States than it is to build it in Australia. But being Australian and working in Australia, and with Australia being originally one of the first countries to bring in a mandated renewable energy target, we chose to develop Australia first. And I guess we wouldn't have got as far as we have without the innovation of the Australian engineers in this new technology.
Mm-hmm. Do you have a projected date for when the first installation will be up in Australia?
We will say by the end of 2009, producing power.
Mm-hmm. What's the construction time for one of these facilities?
Dependent on the size of the plant, approximately 2 years.
Okay. Now, when you talk about Eastern California, at least, I'm not sure about Arizona, Nevada, Texas, and New Mexico, but in California, you've got seismic issues. Would this not be a concern for such a tall structure?
It certainly would be, and that would be one of the issues, and certainly one of the planning issues, and obviously when one does a full feasibility, you would not be building a plant such as this in a seismic-affected area. In all areas, we have small tremors in Australia. We don't have anything like the tremors that occur on the west of the United States. In Arizona, the areas we're looking at, it's very old, it's very aged, and it's very stable. And looking at the seismic activity there, I would have said it's very similar to where we are here,
mm-hmm.
except it's got far better solar radiation. It is very, very good where we're looking. It's very hard for me to sit here and say, the sunny country, you've got sunnier parts of America than we have here.
Yeah. In the cost of installation, you've got these the skirt, which is composed of these solar collectors to pull in the heat.
It's just a translucent material. It's not photovoltaics or anything like that. It's purely a different material that catches heat better. It's purely working as a greenhouse. It's not solar collectors.
Okay. So the amount of the cost is going to be primarily in the tower, is that correct?
No, it's roughly about, I mean, not quite, but roughly probably 40% the tower, 40% the skirt, and 20% the turbines, or maybe not quite 37.5, 37.5, and 25 perhaps. It's the turbines are an item. And we're working very closely with a number of companies in America for the production of this power plant. We're working with Pittsburgh Plate Glass on the provision of the glass portion for the collector area, and we're working with GE and a couple of others on turbines.
Okay, we are at the bottom of the hour, and we have a weekly show by Zenya Rice talking about how we can increase or decrease our energy footprint individually in a practical solution available today. Zenya, go ahead.
Hi, Sterling. Okay, today is about air pollution, mainly indoors. And your ecological footprint, which means the effect you leave on the planet. This measures and estimates how much of Earth's resources of land, air, and water we use and how we dispose of it. How much is needed to supply renewable water, air, and land to be absorbed by us and the plants and the animals? And I've got the great chart of information from my granddaughter from her high school science class. So I'm so glad to hear that global warming is being taught in schools to our youth. Currently, each person's footprint is 20% greater than can be sustained indefinitely. So what kind of footprint effects are you leaving, and what effect is this making on you? We must start to take action to reduce this 20% overuse individually. And a third of all air pollution from motor transportation vehicles, half from fossil fuel power plants and factory smokestacks, and of course all this causes a global warming. I'll have more on that later. In the early 1900s, we had about 38% of air. Today, we have 18% of oxygen in the air. If we go down to 9% of the oxygen in the air, we cannot live. Poor air quality from polluted air, water, and waste overload have resulted in poor health, causing, of course, things like asthma, bronchitis, lung cancer, and so on. Now, about the indoor air pollution and the sources, it creates a sick building syndrome. Here are some causes to check for to prevent and avoid the toxic air in your home and workplace. First of all, you really should purchase a good clean air filtration machine. This will make a big difference in the air quality indoors that we breathe. Check the carbon monoxide level in your home with a carbon monoxide detector for faulty furnace and gas stove leaks. And of course, don't leave an auto running in a closed garage. Make sure your gas stove, wood stove, kerosene heaters are vented to prevent nitrogen oxide leaks. Fungi and bacteria can be found in dirty air conditioning and heating ducts. Asbestos and pipe insulation, old floor coverings and ceiling coverings, and roof shingles, and formaldehyde in carpeting, particle boards, furniture, and foam insulation. So these are things to really look out for polluting your indoor air. And chemical cleaning products, garden products, paints, paint thinners, and so on, should only be open in well-ventilated areas, as well as using air fresheners, moth crystals, and of course tobacco smoke should be ventilated if you do use it indoors. Another thing is air out the clothing before you bring it in the house that was just dry cleaned. And any gasoline stored in containers for lawnmowers, snowmobiles, and so on should definitely be ventilated, not closed in. So be aware of these and other indoor air pollutants, using them and then disposing them properly. Will make a big difference in our health, family, and planet. And for more information, learn about what you can do. Some websites are aninconvenienttruth.com, the Al Gore film, also www.climatechange.com, and energystar.com has many product information. Okay, thank you.
Thank you very much, Zinya.
Right.
For those who are listening in live, you can call in to ask questions if you'd like to talk to our guest and specific issues you might want to see addressed. You can get those phone numbers at freeenergynow.net. In the U.S., the number is 877-876-5227. In Canada, the number is 888-810-8322. If you're calling outside U.S. or Canada, you can call 530-876-3222. We're back to our guest. We have Roger Davey with us today. He's the CEO and Executive Chairman of EnviroMission. He's talking about these tall towers with a skirt about the same diameter as the tower is high to collect the solar sun energy. You get the updraft through the tower that then turns turbines, which generates electricity. They have storage technology that will then gather the sun's energy so that they can crank out energy after the peak sun hours, so that during the peak electricity usage in the morning and in the evening, they can meet demand requirements, and so they can actually serve as a primary energy generation system. Is that correct, Roger?
That's a very, very good summary. Yep. We would be, in power parlance terms, we could be classified as a baseload power plant with the ability to meet peak demand as and when required.
And that's without using batteries. You're just using the storage of the energy, the thermal capacity.
We don't use batteries, no.
Mm-hmm. So that's quite amazing. And you don't, the cloud cover is not an issue. You still get enough energy in. Well, let me ask you. I'm sure that during cloud cover, while you're still getting some solar gain, certainly it's going to be cut some.
Yes, it is, but as mentioned, it works by temperature differential, the temperature at the base of the tower under the collector versus the temperature at the top of the tower, which is obviously outside of the collector and far cooler. So it works by temperature differential, and all modelling has shown if it drops, it drops only slightly. Similarly, with the cleaning of the roof and everything else, it is virtually self-cleaning, and that also does not create an issue.
Would this system work in Alaska?
No. We need areas of, obviously, the best, having said no, yeah, maybe it'll work, but not too efficiently.
Mm-hmm.
We need areas such as the southwest of the United States, such as some of the inland areas of Australia, such as northern Africa, such as the areas of India and Pakistan, such as the Arab states also. We need peak.
Okay. And along with those areas you mentioned, there's also, they're typically an arid desert type area, which indicates more sun, less cloud cover.
That is correct. And there's a number of criteria. Obviously, you like very flat, and as you mentioned earlier, very stable geological ground. You need areas of high solar radiation. We would like to see areas in very close proximity to the existing power grid and also relatively close to an infrastructure area. The area we've chosen in Australia is very, very close to the power grid, and using that as a demonstration alone, it doesn't cost anything or very much capital to connect into the grid. And because of its distance, there's no actual power loss in the connection. Quite often, if you're more site-specific and you've got to build, for example, wind farms in the North Sea off the coast of England, you've got to bring that power that is generated back to land, and there's a lot of line loss, if you like, a lot of power loss bringing it in. We don't have that issue.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not being disparaging about wind there. There could be any power source being a fair way from the grid. There's a number of geothermal plants that are being built. Very, very efficient, very, very good. But you're totally reliant on your geothermal structure to produce the power, which may be a long, long way away from where people live. So therefore, a long, long way away from the power grid, so therefore a very high connection cost to the infrastructure system, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm. If we could divert for a second, I would like to mention that there is another application of this solar chimney technology. If you Google solar home, you will come to a website that I pulled together for my dad's home that integrates seven different solar principles, including the what's called a solar air conditioner. In the summertime, on the east and west side of the home are two towers about 5 meters high, maybe 3 meters high, that have three exposures to the east, south, and west. And the sun heating the air in those towers pulls the hot air out of the top of the house. There's then a cool air intake that comes in through a vegetative area of the yard, goes through the ground about 40 feet, where you get additional cooling from the ground temperature, 57 degrees. That then comes into the basement as the air intake. And so he uses the solar, this updraft principle for an air conditioner in his home.
Yes. I have seen that.
Yeah.
But that's not, when I was referring, that's not using the solar tower to produce electricity as we are.
Right.
It's using as an updraft principle, which is effectively what we're doing. But it's we are an electricity production company, not...
Now, these turbines that are situated in the tower are situated at the base of the tower as the air is coming into the tower.
Correct.
Not punctuated inside of the tower going up
they
the tower.
They are not in the tower, no.
The only purpose of the tower is to provide the temperature differential.
To provide the updraft, the chimney effect.
Mm-hmm.
Correct.
And you're harvesting...
I don't like to use the word chimney because it sort of infers pollution, but... It is scientifically known as the chimney effect.
Is it possible that you could use decommissioned towers that are already built and install a skirt around them to save on some construction costs?
Probably not, because the tower itself and the turbine structure is an integral part of the whole airflow dynamics, the whole dynamics of how it all gets put together and how it all works, which is also subject a lot to intellectual property protection. But that whole integration of turbines and tower and everything else is a very important part of the total construction.
The turbines that you're using, how would they compare to a wind turbine?
Absolutely not. They'd be more akin to a jet engine or the hydro turbines.
Okay. And you have a number of those around the facing horizontal direction, correct?
Correct. Yes, and they would be in banks. On the big mother, the mothership as we refer to it, the one that the video is on our website.
Mm-hmm.
There are 32 6.25 megawatt turbines, which gives you an installed capacity of 200 megawatts. And we would have had those in banks of four, which would mean on servicing, four could be disconnected from the system, serviced, and the other 28 would keep running, so you would still be producing power. If you put the turbines or you had one massive turbine in the tower itself, one, that would be one hell of a massive turbine, but two, once it's off, it's off.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you're not producing any power, so you would have you could have downtime. We've designed this plant for the major efficiency being smaller turbines working at far greater efficiency and having the ability to put them in banks so our downtime is minimal.
What is the slope of the skirt going? You said it's 1 meter at the perimeter. How high? What's the rate of incline as you go toward the tower in the middle?
Okay, if you were looking at the big plant, it would have gone to a little bit over 20 meters off the ground at the base of the tower or where the turbines are situated to incorporate the turbines and the fan blades.
Mm-hmm.
On the smaller plant, because we're using smaller turbines, it will not go that high. But that's what the mother ship was.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. So you've got, that's why... You've got a third or a little less than a third of the cost is in the tower and a third in the skirt because you've got that infrastructure holding up the skirt to a particular height and inclination.
Absolutely. And also to hold that roof in position, you've got a lot of air pressure. You've got a lot of heat under that roof and a lot of wind under that roof. You know, you've got a lot of buffeting going on, so it's a very strong structure. It's not just a piece of plastic hung in the sky. It's a very, very strong structure.
What about external storms, hailstorms and things like that?
Obviously, if the hailstones the size of cricket balls or baseballs or something like that, it would create an effect. We've looked at materials that we've fired ball bearings at and have not managed to break it. The glass will be toughened, and we don't believe that'll be an issue. Obviously, there will be some breaks, and that would be repaired. But history has shown us yet again that the maintenance of the collector roof is not a significant issue.
Okay.
The maintenance issue will be the turbines, and that is also not an issue because they're pressure staged, and they're very, very easy to maintain. They're very slow turning and therefore very slow wearing.
Okay. So let's talk about, let's say, this 50, and you're probably going to change the size from 50 megawatts.
Yes, we probably are.
But let's just say on the 50 megawatt size, how many people would be employed or required to keep that thing operational?
Not very many. It would be a maintenance crew and a security crew, just to secure the premises. And obviously it would be enclosed, fenced in other words. But maintenance, that's really all it would be. Again, all the financial modelling that has been done, the income retention is well into the 90%. So our maintenance costs are very, very minimal. We'd be hoping to retain somewhere between 92 and 95% of our income stream prior to debt repayment and the like.
Mm-hmm. In terms of the model for building this thing, the first one is going to have to be capitalized by, you're paying for it, and then you're going to sell the electricity once it's built. Do you anticipate where people will actually, utilities, for example, will put down a contract and you will actually have the money up front?
We have an agreement with the major power utility in Australia to buy our power. And we also have an agreement with one of the major infrastructure groups in this country. This was under our LETDF application, under that Low Emission Technology Fund application, that they would provide all the all the non-government sector finance for the first plant. So it would depend. There's any number of ways how one would finance a power plant such as this. As you mentioned there, you could sell your power forward or sell a number of years forward to get funds to provide. You could sell some of your environmental credits forward. You could use an infrastructure fund. You could securitize your income stream. You could use traditional infrastructure finance. There's any number of innovative ways that it can be done.
Is it possible you could build it in stages? For example, if the final thing is going to be 300 meters, that you could first build a 100-meter smaller skirt, smaller tower, smaller power output, and then you could, in the next phase, go to 200 meters and extend your skirt another 100 meters in three phases, for example?
I think that has been looked at and has been considered. The tower would certainly need to be built. But having said that, it would depend on the construction methodology of the tower. But it has been looked at building the skirt in like segments of an orange and produce heat, but it would not be as efficient. And again, power companies, when you enter into a power purchase agreement with a company, they're going to want you to meet the requirements under that agreement. I think in the first instance, we would be going forward and building the first plant in its complete form and worry about that then. But, the first instance, it will be a two-year construction period. It will be built, and the income stream will start after that.
Have you considered, I take that back. I'm sure you've had all kinds of scenarios presented to you of how you might tweak or fine-tune your design. I'm just curious, in the discussions, you've got a lot of heat under there, especially at the base of the tower. Is it possible that you could generate electricity from multiple methods, turbines, as well as some effects where you can convert the thermal heat into electricity directly or through, let's say, a Stirling engine, for example? What has been the upshot of those types of analyses?
We've looked at Stirling engines on a number of applications, not to the solar tower. I mean, Stirling engines are used with the dishes, with the power dishes and the power concentrators,
mm-hmm.
And are very, very efficient. The answer is no. We need to use the heat we create to drive those turbines, and we need the temperature drop and the pressure drop to create the updraft. So we need that as clear as possible.
Now, I know just naturally, as you go up in elevation, I think you were saying 1 degree per 100 meters, is that correct?
Approximately, yeah.
The numbers that were shown on the video that you have on your site with the 100 or 1,000 meter tower, it seems like it was like 1,400 degrees at the base of the tower going up to, let's say, 60 degrees at the top. I can't remember exactly, but it was a huge difference.
No, I think the airspeed, the temperature on a normal 30-degree day, and this I do, on a normal 30-degree day, which is centigrade in Mildura, which is not normal, that's quite cool for summer, that video showed it getting, I think, 60-odd degrees under the collector roof and dropping down by 1 degree every 100 metres on the way up, so 50 as she goes out the top, from memory.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay. On a net basis, you've got sun coming in, you're turning that energy into electricity. Compared to that same spot of ground without the device, is the net result a cooling of that spot compared to what it would be otherwise?
Say that again, sorry.
I'm talking about the, if you were to take the system as a whole, the tower, the skirt, and turning that, gathering that sun's energy to turn it into electricity, if you did not have the tower there, you just had bare sand and that taking that same space, is the presence of the tower resulting in a net temperature drop because you're turning sun's heat that would otherwise just be penetrating the ground and being stored in the ground? Instead, you're turning that into electricity. Are you
The ground still, we use the ground even still as a natural storage of heat underneath the collector also.
Mm-hmm.
No change. In fact, it would be warmer. The ground would be slightly warmer.
Because of the darker color of the panels?
Not darker, they're translucent, they're clear, but just because of our method of storing heat, yeah.
Uh-huh. Yeah, maybe not understanding the question. That's okay. It's not an important question. We are coming up to the end of the hour here. I appreciate the time that you've taken to tell us about your technology. Are there any closing thoughts, things that maybe you wanted to include in this presentation that we've not gotten to yet?
Well, I think in summary, I'd like to say that we believe that the technology as it is the creation of a new category of renewable energy, and that is one that can beat the demand profile and can produce power as and when required and not as and when able. We will be able to produce power as and when required and meet that demand profile and create that flexibility. And I think it's something that we will see not only in the country of Australia, but we'll certainly see it in China, and we will certainly be seeing them in the United States of America in the not-too-distant future. And I'd like to thank your listeners and thank yourself very much for your time.
Yes, and if I understand correctly, you're doing this at a price that is comparable to present grid electricity prices. Is that correct?
Correct.
So you have green, clean energy that's not polluting the environment, and you're doing it at the same reliability and power profile as a power plant presently existing.
That's a fair summary.
Thank you very much for your time. It's been nice having you on, and best wishes in your endeavors.
And thank you very much again.
You bet. Take care.
Bye.
Your website. His website is enviromission.au, I believe. If you Google solar tower, it should come up fairly high there. We do have coverage at peswiki.com about their technology, and they've got coverage at Wikipedia and other places. So thank you for joining us.